go and
yeah,
it's ready for you.
Okay.
I'm just really going to start with some basics is all I've got here, yeah. And then I figure from there we'll take off.
I can just introduce myself on there first.
Sure, by all means.
I'm at DeWitt Fields here in my home tonight in Kodiak, and I've lived in Kodiak 44 years, coming up on 45, and it's been my home these many years. I've seen a lot of changes. When I first came to Kodiak in 1949, the 1,700 people lived in Kodiak, and we're just going into a mayor committee type of government. We had an elected mayor and the council members pretty well ran the city. They each would take a separate responsibility. One of them would be in charge of the police department, and one in charge of the roads, and one in charge of utilities, and the different functions of the city. I remember going to some of those early council meetings, and some of them got pretty hot. I remember one night we got into quite an argument, discussion, and one of the citizens that was attending the meeting, he pushed one of the council members' heads through the plastic wall in the city hall. That old city hall is still around. It's out Mission Road, and today it is the front part of the Church of Christ. But that used to sit down here as our city hall. And it was pretty nice hill there. It was solid rock. The city hall sat on that and the federal jail. But after the earthquake and tidal wave, that was all removed, blasted out and moved out. And today the Elks Hall sits just about where the old federal jail and city hall sat. But today we have too much government. We have borough and city government, and borough manager and city manager, and borough assembly and city council. And, we're actually plagued with a lot of people on the government payroll, but little town of size of Kodiak doesn't need all that government. In fact, today I talked to one of the old families, the Naughton family, been here since Russian days. They're making a crusade to get the outside of the city withdrawn from local government, because of those of us who live in the country and pay a steep tax bill receive absolutely nothing for our taxes. There's no way that they can point to any service we receive as justification for the big tax load we pay. Well, I didn't intend to get sidetracked off on this, but I was just introducing myself. My wife and I, we came to Kodiak in June 16th, 1949. We came here on a sailing ship, the Denali, owned by the Alaska Steamship Company. And when we went aboard in Seattle, we had a son 18 months old. That's the only child we had. And we boarded the ship, and we rode to Kodiak in first class. The stewards and we had a top-notch dining hall and kitchen and We were served 3 meals a day on the ship, and all the waitresses had coats and tails and excellent food. And then in the morning about 10 o'clock, we had mug-up time and all kind of pastries and the same thing in the afternoon about 3. And we had lectures on the way up, orienting us about what Alaska was all about. And that time of year, we stopped along the way many places at the fishing villages, delivering supplies as we made our way up the inside passage and then over to Kodiak. They not only haul passengers, but they also haul freight. Kodiak in those days only got a ship once every 3 weeks, and that was one ship. Of course, we were coming right at the tail end of World War II, and they had been 40,000 soldiers, Marines, stationed in this area during World War II, and highly fortified on Woody Island, out at Fort Abercrombie. On the base, all the islands around here, and then clear out towards Shinnyack. Communications went as far as I know about, clear to Kujuyak Bay on the west side, and clear down to Alatak, south. That is, they were bunkhouses and installations. And there was also a couple of Quonset huts in the Sultry Cove that Stolger stayed in. There was an outstation there. And also going over the mountains, there was a radio station just before you went over the top. There was a cookhouse there and a place for a few soldiers to stay. So Kodiak was highly fortified. And
okay. I'll pause real quick.
As I was saying, we got here just at the end of the war. In fact, one day I went to the Navy base and there was only 19 soldiers left. And I talked to the commanding officers there about getting Abercrombie, Fort Abercrombie, to hold the young people's Christian summer camp in. And he said, well, I have 2 boys that I'd like to see into some kind of a camp. I'll just turn the key over to you. And out at Abercrombie, there was a base completely intact. And it just had a steel gate across the road. And he gave me the key. And we had a lot of servicemen in our young people's group here in the Community Baptist Church. So we just invited them to come, and we didn't charge anything. And everybody picked their own house. There were so many Quonset huts out there and places to live. Everything was beautiful in the trees. Nice walkways, well-kept roads, their own power plant system, their own water system, and they had underground bunkers with a command post, and they had 2 big guns out there. They kept the brass shining on them. They was ready to shoot. And so they just turned the whole works over to us. And we had a great camp out there. And the lake out there at Abercrombie, they get their water out of, at that point in time, had a vine that grows on it that spread out over the water, had beautiful pink flowers on it. I even have some pictures of them way back in those days. Now, where they still have those vines and that flower on them out there in the summertime or not, I don't know. I haven't been out at Abercrombie in the summertime for many years. But I just giving you some of the conditions as they were when I came here. In 1949, there was no pavement, there was no gravel. It's probably, there may have been a half a dozen trucks in Kodiak. I only know of two. And the Kodiak Baptist Mission owned those. And that's where we were. We came to be parents in a children's home. We had 14 children for 3 years as mom and dad. And at the mission, we had two trucks. And we would get stuck right down Main Street in front of the businesses with those trucks. And it pretty well remained that way for a few years. And then Mr. Shoup got a contract with the city to pave Main Street. And he paved it with cement. And I mean, he did a good job. Sidewalks were cement and the streets was cement and steel. And that's the way it was until the earthquake and tidal wave. The earthquake and tidal wave didn't phase that road, but it pretty well washed out the rest of the town. And that was March 24th, 1964. So after the tidal wave, we didn't have much of a town as you see it today. And so we instigated an urban renewal project. And with such a project, the whole town was changed. Urban renewal came in, and those of us who had business property down there sold our property to urban renewal. And so when they came in and we had an opportunity to buy it back, it was many times higher than what we got for it, because they came in with the building regulations. You had to have so much space for parking, so much space from the streets, so much space from water line. In other words, with that came a lot of ordinances, building codes. And so many of us were not able to buy the property back. And some of the property, a lot of it, stayed idle until developers and promoters came in and borrowed money from the government, loans and manipulation, and they reestablished businesses down there where you see a lot of them today. Where you see a lot of business today, downtown Kodiak, used to be people's homes. But not only did the tidal wave destroy a lot of the property, but many of them, their homes weren't even touched, but they were aced out of it by the urban renewal project. And I happen to live around here long enough that I've seen that, and I know it, and I know it happened, and many of my friends that are dead long ago were the victims of what happened during urban renewal and the earthquake and tidal wave. And after the earthquake and tidal wave in 1964, Kodiak really began to grow, pick up steam, and move ahead. All the years that I have lived in Kodiak, there have been periods of ups and downs. And when we'd have a downtime, people would get pessimistic and wonder, well, is Kodiak going to fold up? Is my home going to be worth anything? Or should I bail out? And all of that. But Kodiak has made constant progress all the years I've been here. It's gone forward. For instance, there's a home today that sold, the lot and the home sold for $125,000. And I gave $2,700 for the lot and the house that was on it and rented it quite a few years. I bought another piece of property here right off of Mission Road. Coast Guard or Sailor Boy lived in it. And I bought it for $500. He gave me the money and he said, "You let me live in it till I'm gone and I'll give the place to you." And he did. And I sold it for $15,000. And that's the way property values went up here in Kodiak. Today, a lot of piece of properties that you could bought, well, right in front of the high school. I own a home there, that's on two lots, and they were United States patents, and I bought both lots for $500 a piece. Just gives you an idea of property values. And today in Kodiak, those same piece of property would sell for $45,000, $55,000. And that's the way things have gone forward in Kodiak, whether you're talking about homes or streets or property values of any kind. But when I came to Kodiak, two people run the entire city government. Two ladies. One was a bookkeeper, the other sent out water bills and that kind of thing. We had one policeman. We had one person that took care of all the streets, all the maintenance on roads, tractors, the whole works. And you see what we've moved to today. Although we're very modern and we have a lot more conveniences, and which is all very nice, but it costs us a lot of money. For instance, today outside the city limits, I pay a little over $95 a month for just water, sewer, and garbage. When I came to Kodiak, you could have rented a very nice place for $95 a month. And all the water system then belonged to about a half a dozen different systems. We didn't have a water system like we have today. In fact, we had a water system, the Erskine system, and a Sears system. And the city had two makeshift systems. And they were continually trying to catch the surface water up on the back of pillar up there and bring it down, but when it got dry in the summertime, they dried up. Whenever you started digging, try to put in a street or anything, you would always run into a bunch of pipes, somebody's water system you were running into. Most all the water came off the hillside of Pillar here, these little streams you see run when they get a big rain. So that's the kind of water system we had. We didn't have too good a sewer system. They're all septic tanks. Sears out here, he finally put in a system for his houses, and it was just a wooden culvert made of tube of tins, take four of them and make a box, and he ran it from Mission Road down to the beach, and the sewer system ran out there. And around town here, down in the red light district, down below Crafts, there was a big red light district there before the during the war, and there was about two blocks of houses there, and some of the friends of the gals, they donated the materials, and they put in a sewer system that bubbled up out there in the bay. But most of the sewerage was open. I moved to the Baranoff Museum. It was my home. I was the last one that lived there before it became a museum. I lived there 9 years, and it was known as Erskine House, and we had a good sewer system from the house down to the bay, and Erskine had the best water system in town. In the summertime, they were always tapping into my water system. And as far as garbage, I took care of it myself. And I lived there in that Erskine House 9 years. I paid $150 rent for the house, and I rented out rooms. And we had as many as 27 roomers when we were full. And what I had for heat, I had 2 space heaters, one upstairs and one downstairs. And I had a open dorm with beds in that, and I had three private rooms. I rented my rooms $10 a week, and they got fresh linens on Saturday in their rooms. And I rented beds $2 a night for beds, clean beds. And it was a place where many of the people from around the island came in and stayed at my place. They'd go to the hotel, they charged $5 a night. Well, if the hotel thought that they was gonna cause them problems, they detoured them down to my place, because a lot of my clientele was from the village around the islands, and they hit alcohol pretty hard. And they would come down, and I would provide them a place to sleep. I knew a lot of the people around the island, and today some of them have a lot of gray hair like me that used to stay in our rooming house. And so after the earthquake and tidal wave, we moved out of the Erskine House that belonged to Mr. Atchison, and he sold it to the Park Service or for the museum. He sold it to them, and they turned it into a museum. But I must say, some of my most enjoyable days was in the old Erskine House. By then we had 2 children. The third one was born while we stayed there, and made an ideal place as a home for my wife and the children, because it's 100 feet long, and as they got old enough to ride a tricycle, they enjoy riding a tricycle from one end to the other as they would go through the doors of the various rooms. And then we had a big dining area. We entertained a lot, had many lovely gatherings of friends and dinners there. And my wife taught music there in the old Baranoff mansion. And she taught music all the years we were in Kodiak until we both retired together. And then she had her music studio in the old Baranoff mansion. I moved my shoe shop there. I had got into the shoe business in the early 50s. I bought out the only shoe shop in Kodiak, and I had moved it twice before I moved it there. And originally my shoe shop was in the old army latrine, and built by the military to accommodate the servicemen when they were in town. And it stood right where the Canna building stands today. And in 1956, they built the new post office. Where the Canna building is, was built as a new post office. And that new building you see there, where the Canna building is today, I believe I'm correctly, cost about $150,000 to build. Probably now it would cost 750,000. to replace it. But anyway, I moved from the old Army latrine, I moved over to the Baranov Museum. And before I moved it in the Army latrine, it was downtown on Main Street. It was on Torkelson's property, right on Main Street, and my rent was $25 a month. And all rents were cheap in Kodiak in those days, and so a little business had a opportunity to survive if you went in business. And so that kind of gives you a picture of how things were before the tidal wave. We had a long, winding, crooked street with all the small businesses on it, and all were paid for. None of them was in debt to the government because you couldn't borrow money on a little business like that anyway. And so I remember serving on the fire department, and George Magnuson lived up on the hill by the city hall, and when the whistle blew, it was a volunteer fire department, and a lot of times I'd be down Tommy Gallagher's eating a hamburger, and when the whistle blew, he'd throw his apron down and turn off the fire, and away we'd go, grab the fire truck and head for fire. And we had a very good record in Kodiak, very little property ever lost because we were right on top of it. And I remember years ago when I served on the city council, we spent $15,000 for a brand new fire truck. And it had a 500 gallon tank on it and four wheel drive and high pressure pump and hose. And the reason we bought that type of piece of equipment, we didn't have fire hydrants everywhere. In fact, we had very few fire hydrants. And we could get to the fire in a hurry with our high pressure hose and pump. We put most fires out. And our first fire was a city reservoir. I will remember that. But anyway, we got quite a bit of criticism for spending all the money in the city treasure for a fire truck. But today, $15,000 would be postage stamp money compared to the government we have in Kodiak today. But anyway, at the earthquake and tidal wave, that's about all we had in the way of fire equipment. And a lot of times in the wintertime, we'd run out of water. We'd head for the bay and string the hose out in the bay and get our water for putting out the fires. And these were just the early days of Kodiak growing up. And then since 1964, we've done a lot of paving around town and built a lot of new buildings, and there are a lot of new businesses. And we've made, I suppose, what you would call steady progress on the standards of modernization. Now I'll pause for a minute and we'll take off a different direction. Push this, or is it? And the Seine Web is not like it is today. Today you can bring in your seine or your set net and stack it on a pallet board and go back a year later and it'll be just as good as it was when you put it there. But if you don't dry the old-fashioned web out and dry the corks and all of that, the next year you get ready to use it, it'll be rotten. So we used to go to our fish sites at least a month earlier than we do today, and the canneries would open a month earlier, because everybody had to come and get their gear and everything ready. In fact, all of our boats were wooden boats built out of planking. There was no plywood boats. So the plank boats have to be caulked, and they have to be tarred, and they have to be re-nailed, some of them, if they've been used a season or two. And if you're fishing in the Chillicothe Straits, where it's really rough weather, your boats would continually be spraying, and you'd have to keep working on them all the time. We had, in the later years, we had all of our boats built by shipwrights in Larson Bay. Jake Latonin built most of our boats, and they were built of plywood. I remember the first boat he built for me was built out of Sitka spruce, and it cost $500. Complete boat built and painted, $500. Last year we had a boat built from the aluminum, the same length, a little bit wider, and it was $7,500. There's a lot of difference in the cost of what boats are today and what they used to cost. But nevertheless, we have gone to aluminum boats because they don't leak, and we treat them much rougher than we ever treated any boat. But in the Chillicothe Straits, we do spraying a lot of our boats, and we have aluminum welder on grounds that we weld our boats when we crack them or spring them or whatever needs to be done, we can weld them right there. And so fishing has changed considerably. Used to, when I came to Kodiak, there was only one cannery in town. It's where the ship is sitting down here today that belonged to the All Alaska. That's where the cannery sat. It was called Halperty's Cannery. It opened its doors usually about the 1st of April, or long towards May. And the first thing they did was can what they call pioneer clams. And they brought them in from Swishak, over on the other side of the Chillicothe Straits. And Mr. McConaughey, he contracted with a boat as tender, Yarsh. It was one of the larger boats. I would say the Yarsh was probably a 58-footer. And the Yarsh would haul clams from Swishak. And he paid $5 a box delivered to the dock. They would go over early and set up little shacks over there for the clam diggers to live in, over on Swishak. And then they'd bring the clams in the Kodiak, and the workers them days were all local workers, native women. Native women mostly worked in the clam cannery there. And the men would work on the docks and unloading the boat and so forth. And they were called the Pioneer Clam. And after just before Halperty's Cannery went out of business, and they were there until the earthquake and tidal wave, 64, we had a man by the name of McAllister, and he got to fishing crab, and he limped. And whenever we were out fishing salmon, he was out fishing crab, and we thought, well, he must have rocks in his head. And they built a little crab cannery down here on the docks. It was about, maybe 20 feet wide and 30 feet long. And he was going out every day, come back with a load of crabs, king crab. So finally, we had Mr. Wakefield come into the country over in the Straits by Fognac. He set up a big nice cannery over there and started to mess around canning king crab, and it began to catch on here. And all at once, just about everything that would float was out chasing king crab. And that was when they were just starting, the entire fishing fleet would go out and drag. And if you can visualize seeing a drag on the bottom with just a big roll of crab rolling over and over, their legs breaking off and breaking their shells and everything else, not only what they took but what they destroyed, it soon wiped out all the bays around here, and there was no more king crab. But then the bigger boats, they begin to get into the king crab fishing, limit seiners and bigger. And the old timers like myself, right away we wanted to limit the pots to 30. We felt if we kept it at a 30 pot limit, it would provide a good living, and we would continue to have king crab to fish, and we would maintain an industry. But big money, big boats, and outside interests and political power overcame us, and they wanted unlimited number of pots, and many of them had 200 or 300 or 400, you name it, until they wiped them out, and there's nothing left now for anybody. And all the time we had biologists going down studying the king crab. Well, Mr. Norman Sutton and I, one time in May, we decided to take 3 days off and go for a little trip. We went over to Kashuyak with our rifles, and we was hunting bear and just out enjoying ourselves. And we could stop our skiff over the rocks when the tide was going out and they were shallow, and we could take the oars and load up a skiff by just flipping the king crabs off of the rocks underneath the shallow water. And we did that more than once. And in Antoine Larson Bay, there was great big balls of king crab coming in the bay spawning. But because of man's greed, he wiped them out. This exactly the same thing happened to the shrimp. I was here when the first shrimp boat went out. I was here when they put shrimp peelers in the canneries. And when a boat could go out in one day and come back with 80 to 100,000 pounds of shrimp, but there was no limit, no restrictions, and he wiped them out. He took the food right off his own table. And that's the way the crab and the shrimp industry went. And as you know, today when they open a crab season out here, it's a very few days that they're allowed to fish at all. Back when we first started catching king crab, I remember negotiated price one time was 9 cents a pound. And that would make history. Think what they are today. There was no such a thing then as catching codfish or pollock. Not that they weren't here, but there was no market and no one prepared to process them. So if you're living in Kodiak today, you're witnessing a lot of changes taking place every day as you see the steam belching from these canneries down here. You know that they're at work. And I was told this very day that Cook Inlet, they have two shifts going down there. And I don't know how many hundreds of people are working in the canneries right now, but there's a great number of them. And most of them are Mexicans, because the Filipinos have moved out of the canneries and gone to other jobs in town. But I've seen the fisheries go from a strictly salmon fishery and a few pioneer clams to what it is today. For many of the years that I've fished, I can't remember what year we started buying fish by the pound, but it seems to me like it was in the early 70s that we went from buying fish by the fish to the buying them now by the pound. But we used to sell our entire fish. A red salmon, we get maybe 25 cents for a red salmon, maybe 10 cents for a dog, and 8 or 9 cents for pink. Now I'm talking about salmon, not pounds. But it's a different story today. All of our fish are sold by the pound. Now, I'm coming up on just about my 45th year of fishing. Coming from a way back, as I stated before, small little open boats, skiffs, and purse seine, no power blocks, and all that, up to our modern fishery today. And it's been tremendous changes. Now our fish are all bought by the pound. But we used to have a strong fishermen's union here, and that would cover just about all fishermen, and we'd always negotiate with the canneries. But I have a strong feeling at this point in time that our fisheries are controlled by the Japanese. And I saw this all happening. It happened by very slow degrees because they'd be in a lot of resentment if it happened quick, because World War II hadn't been over that long, and for many years after World War II, there was a lot of resentment in the heart of everybody against the Japanese. So they came in slowly. They came in first with their boats to buy the product, and then they began to invest in the canneries, bought out a great number of the canneries, and today they pretty well control what we get for our fish, because they're the ones that buy most of it, and that's where our market is. And they're strong enough and powerful enough that they get together and they establish the market. They pretty well set what we're going to get for fish. I'm making two trips every year now to Seattle to meet with a fish buyer, because I have an interest in the cannery. And it's the Japanese that buy our fish. They're the ones we'll meet with and negotiate with them. And I'm very conscious of their negotiating methods, but there's nothing that can do about it, because they're the only market that we have. Because of the very poor market in pinks, there's a lot of people become concerned enough about it that at this very point in time, there's different products coming off of the market that's being made out of pink salmon. And that the senior citizens, last Thursday night, I ate one of those products, and it was very good. It was a ham made from pink salmon. And it they're smoked hams. They're little bitty packages, maybe a pound or pound and a half in. And you buy them, and you can slice it, and it looks just like ham. And you wouldn't know it was ever a pink salmon. But there are things like that being developed that hopefully will change our marketing situation. Well, I first had a seiner And the way I got that Sainer, I was in partnership with Mr. Knute Solberg, who established a homestead at Mill Bay out here. Him and his brother each established a 160-acre homestead. And Newt, he had chickens. He sold chicken eggs on the base in Kodiak. So he had a contract with the Navy to haul all their scraps from their mess halls, and they operated three mess halls. And there was a lot of scraps. So all you had to do was make one trip a day, and you'd get enough garbage, scraps, to feed 500 or 600 chickens. Well, anyway, Newt, he was going to gather the eggs, wash the eggs, encase them, and take care of the chickens, and I'd haul the garbage. Well, it came summertime, and this pushke around here grows 6 feet tall, and other weeds and grass and bushes, and the chickens would hide out and steal a nest out, and Newt would find their eggs and put them in a big bucket and pour water on them, and he'd never check the eggs to see if they were good or not. So I had a lot of problems with selling eggs that had chickens in them. And I was selling them to a lot of women that worked on the Navy base. They had their own quarters out there. And but Newt and I were in chicken business for a couple of years there together. And so finally, Newt, he homestead 160, but he finally settled and he got 5 acres, and which was later sold to the Naughton family, and they turned it into a trailer court, which has been sold a couple of times since. But that was at Mill Bay. And Newt built the original home there. He built it out of logs. And he had a little 8N Ford tractor he used to pull the logs up to build the house. And he lived there for many years. When he died, he left a will, and he and I, when he was living, tried to establish a old folks home here, and we couldn't get any interest. And finally, when Newt died, he left about $13,000, and he left it administrator, a friend of his, who was can't think of his name right now. Carl something. But anyway, Carl and I, we tried to get somebody interested in starting an old folks home, and we contacted Lutherans and the Baptists and a few others, and we couldn't get anybody interested because we didn't have enough money to do anything. So Carl, he died. Carl Brumstead was his name. He died, and he left that money in the estate, and the estate was turned over to Roy Madsen, the attorney, hoping that someday he'd get somebody interested in building an old folks home here, a senior citizen's place. Well, after the earthquake and tidal wave and the state came into oil money, that kind of took care of itself, because the state built them all over the territory, and the money that we had was turned over to the senior center here, or maybe the hospital got some of it, I just forget. But anyway, that's the way that went. And even though the Senior Citizen Center here today is a dream of a lot of old timers that's gone, passed on, but they was always hoping that we would have a senior center. And so I got a ranch. And on Larson Bay, I traded my home in California. I got involved in the ranching. It's going on 40 years ago now. And we had a very effective ranchers organization on Kodiak Island. At one time, we had in excess of probably 5,000 head of cattle. But we've lost all of our ranchers, are dead now, except just four of us. Four of us left. And when the natives got their land, natives land claim settlement, they wanted all the cattle off. And they will not release the land because any time that they make any kind of an income off of any of their property, they have to pay taxes. And so it was a blow to the cattle industry. My ranch went completely to the Uzica Native Corporation. And Les Noyes selected Middle Bay here was a ranch. And Old Harbor selected Sicalitic Island. And so a lot of our ranches were destroyed with that land selection, and nothing moved in to replace it. So I say it was not good. It was not good because the native haven't utilized the land, and they killed the ranches that was operating on it. And so I did not, in 1971, when the land settlement claims came down, I did not protest the Uzinki Native Corporation selecting my ranch because they had promised to give me my homestead, 160 acres. But as time rocked along, it was many years before they ever got title. The old timers that I was dealing with died off. And instead of them wanting to give me my homestead, they only wanted to give me 5 acres or nothing. So I went to court and I fought them for 5 years. Cost me about $60,000. But finally, as events changed, and over that process of time, they saw that they was getting themselves in an unfavorable position. They wanted to negotiate with me. And we negotiated for 120 acres. That's what I came up with in Anton Larson Bay as my homestead. That's what I own there today. And I am improving it. I plan to continue to improve it as long as I live. But I don't intend to ever have any more cattle there. I have quite a few horses.
Where is that at?
It's 15 miles from Kodiak. You go out to the housing area there at the base, Nimitz Park, and make a right-hand turn, go right over the mountain by the ski chalet, and right on down to the beach. And that's been was my ranch for 10 miles each way there for over 30 years. That's where my homestead is. And I will continue to do that, although there is a move right now to get the outlying districts out of the Kodiak borough because we have a high rate of taxes and we don't receive any benefits. Yeah. There's not one benefit that you can point to that none of us receive outside of Kodiak. And I pay $1,500 taxes a year on that 120 acres. And I don't see one thing that I'm getting for my taxes, as well as all the other people out the road and all. But anyway, that's the way it is, and I plan to improve it. I've opened up two businesses there. One is boat storage, and opening very shortly is a little restaurant where people going out that way can stop and have a cup of coffee, a piece of pie, or some cookies like that, and Debbie Olson that lives out there for the last 15 years, she's going to operate it, run it. Her and I are going in partners together. But, in 1974, we built a slaughterhouse at Bell Flats. And us ranchers got together, incorporated, and that was after the tidal wave. We lost all of our slaughter facilities. They washed out off of the ranches. I mean, they went out to sea and circled around and busted up. We didn't have any place to slaughter. So temporarily, we got one of the old buildings there at Bell's Flats warehouse and set up there to slaughter in. And went to Juneau and got a loan for $150,000 to build the present slaughter facility that you see out there today. Mm-hmm. The same facility today, you couldn't build it for $750,000. You could not. And anyway, in the 20 years, next year will be 20 years it's been built, we've never paid out 1 hour of labor. We've always done the slaughtering ourselves, a cooperative deal. We help one another. I've been president of the co-op most all these years myself, and we have our monthly meetings, discuss our finances and our business and our future plans. And we have the state above board. Our loan is almost paid out. We're almost solvent, and we're in the black.
Right.
And have been for quite a few years, but we don't have any paid employees. And we have a pretty nice little business going out there now. Not the co-op, but one of the members of the co-op, Mr. Dorman. He's smoking hams and fish and pigs and all kinds of stuff that they're doing out there. I was there today in the co-op showing a friend of mine around. And at the present time, I have all my cattle out on the Burton Ranch. Mr. Burton has, a few years ago, decided to slowly phase out his cattle and go into buffalo. And the primary reason for that is because bear predation. I think it was a wise and a smart move, because that's always been the number one problem here, is bear predation. And unless you've been in the cattle business, you don't know how severe bear predation can be. The time of the year the cows are having their young is the time of the year that the bears are coming out of hibernation. They've absorbed a lot of their fat while in hibernation. And they're just like an athlete. When they come out, they get their digestive system working. They walk around and eat a few roots and